Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Our guest today is Andy Matuszek. He's a software engineer, designer, and researcher. He helped build iOS at Apple and led R&D at Khan Academy. His current interest is technologies that expand what people can think and do. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Hey, thanks for that introduction.
Technology has radically changed the way that we seek out and interact with information. But the methods of formal education, the way that we acquire knowledge, haven't really seemed to change much since the ancient world. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting the ways that that's true and that's not true. When I got started on my ed tech journey, maybe 7 years ago or so, that was definitely the story that I told. You know, there's another common story that the current school system is kind of created in Prussia and hasn't changed much since then. And while that's true to a large extent, it's interesting also to talk about all the ways in which it's not true. So for instance, discussion-oriented classes being highly commonplace in say like primary and secondary education is a relatively new emphasis in the last few decades. So Montessori-like schools starting at the beginning of the 20th century have been trying to push their way up through secondary school. So I find these trends promising. I find some of the Common Core's attempts to emphasize reasoning and argumentation in addition to rote, factual, and procedural knowledge promising. Simultaneously, there are a lot of entrenched forces that make it difficult for these types of reform or progressive-minded education policies to move quickly. Everything has to kind of move together. Very large institutions consisting of many parts, many different disciplines, from the teachers on the ground to the administrators who have certain expectations, backgrounds, and training, to the funding sources for the schools, which are often dependent on certain practices and assessment behaviors, to, yes, those assessments, which for the Common Core rollout, for instance, like one challenge is that the assessments are not as progressive-minded yet as some of the standards in the Common Core. So teachers are caught between a rock and a hard place there. Likewise, parents can cause difficulty as well as opportunity either direction. You know, either they can be like more progressive in the classroom and trying to like drag everybody to the future, but just as commonly the parents often express concern when their child is learning something in a different fashion than they learned it. They can sometimes feel like their child is getting a short shrift or is like not being taught properly or something like that.
Well, we have this some weird things that are persistent in our at least our public education system and some private schools. One that always has struck me as interesting is grouping children by age. It doesn't seem to have been rethought much. Where I'm like, the age does not correlate to ability necessarily.
Right.
It might, but we just sort of do it, and we kind of think that there's no other way of doing it. Like, which I mean, I don't know if you've looked into that if there's an alternative way of doing it. We did, of course, used to have one room schoolhouses where, 15-year-olds and 7-year-olds were together, which actually could have been beneficial. But now we just sort of segment them out, and that's one of the weirdest things about schools. It's one of the only places in your entire life that you'll be with people with your own age as like a general rule. And so you don't really learn about the fact that when you get a job, there'll be someone who's 50 and someone who's 25 and you might be 18. So that's always struck me as weird. And we're not really thinking outside of that box.
Yes, there are some reform-minded schools which are kind of taking alternative approaches there using grouping children by, say, readiness or independence levels, things like this. But one fun thing about this question or concern is that it really starts to access what do you actually view school as being for? And for instance, if you view it as being primarily like a psychosociological developmental institutions, it's there to kind of like help you grow as a person and relate to others effectively, then maybe it would especially make sense to group many ages together in the sort of one room schoolhouse style model, because maybe socialization is going to work better in that context. There's some evidence of that up to some threshold where things get tricky. Whereas if what you view the goal as is something like learning a bunch of skills to enable either like future vocational work or you know, entrance into the great process of humanism and discovery, then you might wish to group people by, say, knowledge or capacity or something like that. Ages. Well, actually, an interesting thing that I learned at Khan Academy is that in a typical school, that the smear of abilities in a given class is absolutely enormous. And for many teachers, this really is their number one problem. The most common concern or complaint we had when talking to, for instance, middle and high school math teachers in particular, was the absolutely enormous variation in their students' capacities, both like conceptually, just, you know, comfort with numbers, as well as just practically their ability to do certain things. And so they have to somehow teach a class that includes students who are nominally or from some standards perspective, 2 years behind where they're supposed to be, as well as, of course, there's others who are, you know, a year ahead or something.
That reminds me of my wife is an elementary school teacher. And when we lived back in Denver, she taught at a private school for gifted children. And the way that they handled that, because gifted kids vary wildly, was she would essentially write individualized curriculum for each of the 15 or 20 kids in her class. And it was all built around, like, if this kid was really into hockey, she would build the entire curriculum of math and science and history around hockey.
Amazing.
Which was wonderful for the kids. But like, as the spouse who saw her working in the evenings, it was rather labor intensive. So it didn't scale as well, but
yeah, although I don't know, maybe it's not that unreasonable. So there are 55 million U.S. K-12 students. And so if you imagine that a teacher can only support 20 students, which maybe that's an upper limit for that kind of endeavor, then you'd need 2.7 million teachers to support those students. And maybe that's not that outlandish.
Yeah, probably not. One thing I like, I've known Aaron for 20 years going back to Denver, and one thing I liked about what his wife was doing as a kid who was really into things, like growing up, I think probably all of us were, you know, just get really into dinosaurs or baseball, or I had an obsession with Anne Boleyn. I had some weird obsessions when I was growing up, but like, you know, that kid is sort of, they like to focus a lot on one thing. So she had to, you know, how do you teach math through hockey? Well, that's pretty easy. Like, you know, goals, statistics, but it's going to be, how do you teach math if the person is interested in the human body or something like that? But I think that goes to some of your work, where if you're trying to get understanding, but you go through something that the person wants to understand, as opposed to this sort of transmission model, right? Where it's like, so many kids hate school, but they love learning about other things, you know, outside of school, like, you know, even if it's something kind of silly, like Pokemon, you know, characters or something.
Yeah. So like, they can recite all 150, but they, you know,
exactly. And their stats. Right? Yeah.
That was so, like, a popular topic in the gifted school.
So how do we harness those things together? Like, people have a passion for learning. I think even people who don't seem to have a passion for learning have that. So how do we get those to kind of meet so they can actually get skills, if that's the point of what we're doing here?
Yeah. This access is a fundamental rift and challenge in the reform education space, stretching back, especially over the 20th century. The challenge that many people have had in trying to produce, say, student-directed learning environments has often been that they don't quite take it far enough. So one common challenge that we encountered when talking to those types of institutions at Khan Academy was that, like, the teachers really wanted to just support the students in investigating whatever they wanted to investigate, but the district or the parents or the somethings would eventually get in the way. And this was true even at the Khan Academy Lab School, which was this very strange experimental school without concrete curricula. One common refrain from those teachers was that the parents will talk a big talk about wanting their kids to follow their interests and their passions. And yet, at the end of the day, when they come in for those teacher-parent meetings, they're like, but my kid's going to get into Stanford, right? Like, that is a thing that is very important to them. So you have to thread this, like, multi-institutional needle. And no one's quite figured out how to do that yet. One other interesting challenge is something that John Dewey points out in Experience in Education, which is that particularly before people have developed their their sense of self and a prefrontal cortex, allowing such a person or encouraging them to do whatever they want in a given moment, it's kind of worth asking if such a person is truly free. If a person is kind of following their momentary whims at all times without having developed wisdom, is that actually less free than a person who's kind of gently guided or shown opportunities they might find interesting in a non-coercive fashion, but with like slightly more constraint?
A lot of your recent work has been on kind of personal knowledge databases and knowledge synthesis. And I'm thinking about that in the context of what we've just been talking about, because that project is almost by definition like cross-disciplinary. You're trying to take a lot of different fields, a lot of different kinds of knowledge, a lot of different directions, and figure out how to synthesize new ideas out of them. But the way that we tend to approach education, particularly at like elementary level or high school, is to compartmentalize. So you're not learning the way that my wife taught, which is we're going to learn about hockey, and through hockey, we're going to learn math and science and all that. It's rather you're going to do science, and then you're going to learn reading, which is kind of an odd subject in and of itself, because reading is just how you approach everything else. It's not its own thing once you've learned your letters. Does that kind of trap us? Like, do we need to break down that compartmentalization of disciplines in order to be more effective?
Yes, and actually, this is a place where most of the educational institutional forces are supportive of doing that. So the Common Core actually includes a lot of provisions and encouragement for this to happen. The reading standards, for instance, they include standards for speaking and listening that are supposed to be applied to subjects other than just like your English class, for instance. So in order to like achieve the English and Language Arts Common Core standards, you actually have to be working on those things in the context of a science class or something, because they include standards around like analytical and quantitative thinking. Now, where that's met trouble is with some of these forces I discussed earlier, that on the ground, it can be very difficult to do this. Like as it happens, you have, say, an English teacher and a science teacher, and the science teacher is kind of like rewarded and incentivized for the student's performance on the science assessments at the end of the year. And the English teacher is not really rewarded or incentivized or even has any feedback around how the student performs on, say, like the quantitative speaking and listening type assessments. So all the teachers I've talked to about this have expressed great difficulty in getting anything to change. And this is much, much more true for the math standards and the science standards, which are still somewhat more nascent, which attempt to be cross-cutting, because those require domain expertise that many of the relevant teachers don't have, either practically or they may have like an emotional aversion. So trying to bring like number talk into history, for instance, is super interesting. You're going to talk about like means of production, in the 18th versus the 19th century. Actually, looking at those numbers can really give you a visceral sense for what happened. But many of the people teaching those types of courses have very strong aversions to mathematical thinking.
Now this is going to sound bad, but you've come out against books in some ways, or at least you have some issues with some ways that some books are thought to be used would be the more. So what's the problem with especially nonfiction books that you have pointed out?
Thanks. Yeah, I should be clear that this is more a provocation than a criticism. I in fact love books, but I think it's interesting to look at objects with their purposes in mind, and then to ask how well the object is sculpted to fulfill that purpose. And so if we imagine that in an informational text, for instance, that the aspiration is that a reader is going to somewhat reliably be able to internalize a particular perspective or set of strategies, methods, even basic facts, it's interesting how little books actually seem to do as objects, as media, to facilitate that. And it's true also for even things like self-help books. You know, if you read a book about trying to, say, form habits better, Like you might sit down and read it. They're usually like really short. So you read it in an hour and a half, and then you close it and you put it back on your shelf and you go about your day. And then something might happen, which would benefit from one of the ideas in that book. And yet like the author is back on your shelf at home and is no longer participating. So I'm not really saying this to criticize books as much as to ask, is it possible to invent media forms which can do the jobs of, say, informational texts or, you know, your self-help book on habit, but which actually, say, participate more deeply or take into account how people think and learn more effectively, things like this?
It's not a TED Talk. I mean, it's like at least part of the point, right?
Maybe. I mean, I would argue that a TED Talk is also quite ineffective. I mean, it's interestingly different in that it may have a, say, like a visceral or a deep emotional reaction. But I guess I'm suspicious how much long-term effect a TED Talk has on a person. Maybe that's what you're saying.
You've, as a way to reinvent the book, to, I think, accomplish more of what you're talking about, you've co-authored, I believe, an online textbook on quantum mechanics. Can you tell us, so kind of use that as a way to give us a more concrete version of what you were just talking about?
Sure. Yeah. So one thing that's interesting about very complex topics is that raw working memory can actually become a barrier very quickly. So if you're trying to learn, say, a complex topic in economics, and chapter one introduces a whole bunch of new terms and new approaches, and then chapter two starts trying to put those to use very quickly to solve problems, you know, your working memory is really quite limited, and you may find that you can't actually keep all of those things in mind simultaneously because you've just been exposed to them. And this may make it difficult for you to learn complex topics, including those like quantum computation. So what do we know about memory? Is it possible to take advantage of what we know about memory in order to try to do better? That's what this book, Quantum Country, is exploring. Cognitive scientists actually understand fairly well how to ensure that you'll remember something. This is kind of a familiar thing in everyday life. You know, if you hear about something once, then often you'll forget it fairly rapidly. But, you know, if you hear it again, then maybe it'll last a little longer. And then if you hear it again, it'll last a little longer than that. And so ideally, you actually kind of want to hear about it just as it's maybe likely to fade away each time. And if you do that, you can actually very efficiently with say, only half a dozen reinforcements over the course of a year, keep something in mind quite reliably. It's just that books don't really, do anything to help you do that. You'd have to be like very diligent and assiduous and make yourself a little planner or whatever. So Quantum Country has that mechanism built into it. So as you read, there are these little questions, almost reading comprehension questions. They're very simple about things that you've just read, a little bit like some other online textbooks. But where it differs is that it'll follow up a few days later and you'll look back at all of those things again and kind of test yourself again on your memory of those things. And for the ones which you still remember, you'll then test yourself on them again or quite some time later, say several weeks or a month. And then for the things that you're struggling with, you'll see them again sooner to reinforce them. And so after a few rounds of this, we found that readers are able to internalize quite reliably, really a very large amount of information from this book.
So is there an app that comes with it that like Duolingo, like it prompts you to answer questions?
It sends you an email. Yeah.
Okay. I could tip. So, I mean, are we, I remember back growing up, there was a lot of discussion, and I'm sure you probably know the source of this because we have different education theorists who kind of come through at different times, but there was like the auditory learner, visual learner, like kind of categories that came through, which always struck me as a little bit facile. For me, I always thought I was a learner who struck as soon as I kind of grokked it, to use the Stranger in a Strange Land, like as soon as I kind of got it and I could recombine it in my own head, that was the moment that I wouldn't forget it. And I've always thought that when I was like seven, I kind of realized that when I came up with a totally different way of doing averages. that was just different than what I was taught. Like, I mean, it wasn't complex or anything. I just was doing it differently. And so, and I would never forget it. Like, that seems to me to be the, what we should pursue. I don't know how to get there, but like, anyone, is the moment you understand it, then it's harder to forget, like really grok it, what's actually going on. So like, is that part of the field that you work in?
I would like it to be this book as design. I should say my co-author is Michael Nielsen. Our approach here is this kind of artificial and formal integration approach. So it's not relying on you using this knowledge to, say, run some quantum computing experiment, which would be more natural and more pleasant and probably just better if you could make it work. So it's a very interesting challenge to ask, like, can you do something which accomplishes the same outcome as quantum country for people's memory without these kind of artificially constructed review sessions? And my reference there is games. They are, some of them, the best of them, are so good at this. The real challenge with creating these like naturalistic, say, project-based learning environments is that you need to structure the projects in such a way as to make use of the pieces of information that the student's trying to learn, but not too many new pieces of information at once. And so in some fields, kind of the obvious first project might actually require that you've internalized dozens of key ideas. And so you have to find some way to break it down. Because games are kind of inherently artificial, they're very good at doing this. Games like Portal will have you learn like each idea atomically. And people have broken down like the learning structures of Portal, and they're amazing. So it remains to be seen whether this can be done in general for topics. I've actually been assembling notes on this question, but I don't know how to do it yet.
It seems like what you've described with Quantum Country, like that, in order to make that work, you had to write a textbook about a very specific topic and bake in a lot of additional stuff into that textbook beyond the text itself, which is places a large workload on you as the co-author or curriculum designer or whatever else, which then means that for, you know, it's unrealistic that we would have similar sorts of elaborate things for every potential topic. But on the other side of it, it seems like this kind of thing, like say using spaced repetition flashcards diligently, as a student learning whatever topics it is that you're exposed to or interested in over time, you like you're saving yourself a lot of work, right? Like if you can be diligent up front, you can then all you have to do is pop into your Anki flashcard stack or whatever once a day and just run through them. And over time, the number of cards you have to look at diminishes as you learn them. So you save yourself time in the long run, but it requires not just a large time commitment, but almost like making a good version of that flashcard deck requires something of a deep understanding of the subject to begin with, so that you're making the right flashcards. And so it seems like so much of the way that education works now is the teacher gives me an assigned reading. I know that I'm going to read it. We may discuss it, but like reading it is what I have to do. And I can kind of, it's a concrete thing. And then I know that I'm going to be tested on it and I can study for that test and then I'm done. But this seems to like load a lot more onto the student and in ways that it's not necessarily possible for the student to offload. Is that a problem for this kind of thinking, or are there tools we can use to help there?
Yeah, these are all open parts of the research question. These are good questions. So Quantum Country offers up this kind of trade. And in fact, this is really the core insight of it. You referred to spaced repetition. That's like kind of the general name for the mechanism which Quantum Country is adapting. And spaced repetition is extraordinarily effective. So it's worth asking, why don't people use it? The number of people who use it is very tiny, and yet it is it really feels quite like magic. And as you point out, I mean, one of the key reasons is that it's very costly, and it is both costly in time and is challenging to make these flashcards. It requires both the domain expertise, which you pointed out, but it also requires expertise in this weird medium of making flashcards, which is surprisingly difficult. And it's not even obvious that it's difficult. So a very common phenomenon is that people start trying to do this, and it doesn't seem to work very well. And I think it's because like just this technique doesn't work very well. And so they give up, but actually it's because their flashcards aren't good. So Quantum Country's core insight is, what if the author creates the flashcards and there's kind of a time trade. So they have to do a bunch of work up front, but maybe you scale it to tens or hundreds of thousands of students and it makes sense. There's downsides. Making the flashcards actually is very, very good for your learning because you have to do this like distillation and synthesis of knowledge. And you'll like spend more time in contact with the material and it'll be more personal and probably connected to things that you care about or you know already know about better. But it's an interesting trade to explore. So then the question is like, what's the right mix? So maybe there's like crowdsourced wiki style flashcard layers that you put on top of pre-existing texts. Or another way I think about it is writing these prompts embedded within Quantum Country, it is still less effort than like writing the problem sets, which would normally be in a textbook. And yet authors do write problem sets or exercises in textbooks. So I think the absolute amount of work is not unreasonable, that there's just kind of like a getting it off the ground effect challenge.
Now, Aaron and I both have philosophy degrees, undergrad and law degrees. And with the Khan Academy stuff and the kind of flashcard or repetition, at least where a question can be asked to you, it seems that they're not easily transported to the humanities in the same way. If you're talking about large historical periods and understanding what's going on there, I couldn't, if I got an email that was like, describe the 19th century, in 5 minutes, that would be a little difficult. Or, I mean, I didn't make many flashcards in my philosophy classes for my test. So, is that a totally different, do we have to think about that totally differently and say, you know, this isn't about spaced repetition. This is about conversations maybe. So you really get the ideas of Wittgenstein or Plato or whoever, rather than this kind of other learning model.
Right. So I don't know, first and foremost, but I will say that as an amateur student of both philosophy and history, these types of techniques have been quite helpful. They just look a little different than you might be used to. So, first off, it is just helpful to have simple prompts like what is sentimentalism, for instance. That's not all that interesting. So once you've been practicing for a little while in philosophy, you would just know that by way of trying to have debates with people about different philosophers' approaches to problems. And then you can do these kind of higher order prompts that are more creative or more comparative by, for instance, asking things like, compare and contrast positivism and existentialism. There's kind of some interesting overlaps there. What are their similarities? And one interesting thing about that question is that you might find yourself actually giving somewhat different answers over time as your understanding develops. And so in a way, this prompt is playing a different role that I'm also finding very interesting, which is that it's a way of programming your attention. So as kind of a novice philosophy student, the first time you consider a question like the difference between those two worldviews, your answer might not be very deep. And so you'd almost like to program yourself to like return to that question, perhaps not on the same like very tight memory oriented schedule, but say a couple of times in your first year to see if you have new things to say about it. And so this lets you do that. I've also created in my amateur study of philosophy, kind of creative-oriented prompts with a similar focus on kind of programming myself to practice. And one example would be like, take a recent decision that you made and imagine what your, or decide what your answer to that decision, your choice to that decision would have been if you had taken only a deontological perspective. How would your answer have changed? And that's very interesting because it definitionally has different answers every time.
In this world, though, if we shifted entirely to a world where people were using textbooks like the one that you co-authored and were creating decks of cards and programming their attention and all of that, what is the role of teachers? I mean, outside of being the people who write the textbooks and all of that, like, is there a role for teachers in the traditional sense in that world?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm kind of a partisan in this sense, and so this will reflect a worldview that's not certainly not universally held in the education space. But I view teachers primarily as facilitators. So arranging discussion is I think one of the most valuable things that a teacher can do. And it doesn't really matter how many flashcards a person's practiced. A well-arranged discussion between experts on essential questions can still generate new knowledge. And so it can definitely generate new knowledge for children or for undergrads. Another, of course, important role for a teacher, particularly for young people, is just facilitating their emotional, even spiritual, psychological development. And then, especially in higher ed, an extremely important role that the teacher has is being something like an ambassador for their culture. So if you are a professor of philosophy, one of the things that you're doing is like modeling a way of thinking and being in your every word in conversation, and you're expressing a system of values and norms. And that's very difficult to absorb from a book. So those are some of the things that I think teachers are still very important for.
This morning, I was wandering through your notes, which you've put online at your website, and I encourage our listeners to do that because it's a fascinating experience to go through these linked notes.
These are rough working notes, I should clarify.
Welcome to Andy's brain kind of thing. Yeah, I went through them.
I had a lot of fun going through it, but I came across this line that I wanted you to expand on, because both Trevor and I are knowledge workers. We're scholars. Our job is, you know, learning about stuff, having conversations about it, and writing about it. And so one of your notes, you say, athletes and musicians pursue virtuosity in fundamental skills much more rigorously than knowledge workers do, which feels right to me, but I'm not sure why it's right, like why that's the case.
Sure. This is happily a question which more talented people than I have also spent some time thinking about. Kanders Erickson, one of the founders of the field of expertise, thought this question was very interesting. He didn't get very far in trying to answer it, I would say, but he kind of gave one simple answer which might explain why, and that's that it's very difficult for knowledge workers to do otherwise. There are certain fundamental differences, which he characterizes, between the types of work which make it very difficult to engage in what he calls a deliberate practice. So the thing that the athletes and the musicians are doing every day is deliberate practice. And a simple way to define that is an activity whose sole purpose is to improve your performance in some particular domain. And so it's interesting that, you know, we knowledge workers, we do stuff all the time that makes us better. You know, we're reading papers, we're like writing that book that pushes us out of our comfort zone or whatever. But the sole purpose we're doing it is not to improve ourselves. I mean, almost ever. Whereas an athlete, like daily, is doing activities whose sole purpose is to improve themselves. And so why don't knowledge workers do that? Well, we don't quite know how. So some properties of athletics, for instance, and say violin playing, that Erickson talks about. One, it's very easy to very rapidly assess performance, even at a particular sub-skill. Two, there is specific knowledge about the teaching and improvement of sub-skills. So there's like coaching knowledge. Three, there is like a generally well understood and agreed upon kind of standard of like what good is, and kind of a curriculum and so on. It doesn't exist really for knowledge workers. And four, there's like a culture and community of coaches who in these fields are previously eminent practitioners. So it would be as if, I don't know, like Robert Caro, like instead of writing his next Lyndon B. Johnson book, you know, decided to like spend all his time like teaching the next generation of great writers or something like that. We don't quite have that. We sort of do in some small limited cases. And so on. Now, Erickson kind of stopped there. I think he's maybe a little more pessimistic than he needs to be. I mean, yes, it's true that there aren't, I can't specify like a complete set of criteria for being a great knowledge worker, but maybe we can agree on things like you need to be able to like collect, synthesize, and distill like a lot of information effectively and update on that information. Like maybe that's just kind of like a core skill of knowledge work in most knowledge work fields. It doesn't seem that implausible to me that we could, create some kind of like a game where you have to do that, or create some kind of a task or test or something where you have to do that. And that you could say, assess it fairly rapidly or like find ways to improve. So I'm a little more optimistic that we may actually be able to identify some of the core tasks and behaviors in knowledge work and possibly then start trying to improve them very intentionally.
I want to take a step back or step up to the 30,000 or 100,000 foot view. Now, as libertarians like are critical of state education as a concept, and I don't really necessarily want to get into that, but one of the reasons I find it a fascinating question is because it presupposes an agreed upon definition of education, which I think is actually the rub there, where it's like where we don't. We think we could say the three R's, but you even find disagreement there. Well, how much arithmetic do you need? That we have calculators in our pocket. We need music. We need art. We need global stewardship, and that there's actually the heterodoxy of humans, which is only increasing, is making it even more of a quixotic endeavor that we can collectively define the meaning of the concept of education. So does that mean that we should be pulling back or at least diversifying, especially as we become more diverse in our education, as opposed to make it monolithic, which is kind of inherent in the state itself?
This is a huge challenge. And I'm broadly in agreement with what I perceive to be your skepticism of this kind of the project of trying to create a unilateral or monolithic perspective on what education is. Like, three primary perspectives, each of which is valid. I discussed two of them earlier. One is essentially personal development, and two is like skill development, either vocationally or for like a humanistic perspective. And then three is like the citizen's perspective. You need to like create a citizenry. I don't think I can make a knockdown argument that any of these is right. It really depends on like you and your community and your culture and your values, and that's just the fundamental question of what this whole thing is even for. And so that even if you were to accept one of those things, like the Platonic perspective, which is one label for this kind of skills oriented perspective, then there's still tons of reasonable people can disagree style debate about like what skills you should be learning and so on. And so the role of things like Common Core mostly plays a factor in the domain of equity, where I don't know about that project specifically, but really the project of the education space over the last couple of decades has had just enormous success. So there's a story that I can tell that has like a really sad ending and like kind of a really happy ending. There's this thing called the NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, that's been running for a really long time. And every year it collects some sample of performance in mathematics and reading and writing from fourth graders, eighth graders, and 12th graders, I think. And it's pretty incredible to see how little progress has been made in general after decades of work in education in, say, the median eighth grader mathematics abilities. And it's especially galling when you look at like how much we spend on education, for instance. The combination public-private sector spending is $1 trillion a year. It's pretty crazy. But so that's the sad part of the story. The happy part of the story is that the achievement gap has closed substantially, and you can define that various ways. But basically, if you look at say subgroups, whether they're demographic or economic subgroups, that previously lagged behind by like multiple tens of percentage points, they're now lagging behind by say, single digit percentage points. And most of the story of how that has happened, I shouldn't say most, a large chunk of how that has happened has been this kind of standardization where it's like, well, maybe we can't agree on what education's about, but there are some like core things that maybe many of us can agree it should be about, and we can figure out how to do those well and reproduce them. And then the perspective that many of these people have that I don't necessarily agree with is, all this stuff about personal development and like finding yourself and pursuing your passions or whatever. Like that's all really nice to have when like your parents can eat. But maybe if they can't, then you should focus on like being able to, get a decent job or something.
I've been struck by how much the internet has kind of changed independent learning in a way that, you know, when I was my children's age, so I was in elementary and middle school, I learned in school, and then I would like go to the library and get a book, or I would ask my parents something. But that was kind of the mechanisms I had for learning about a new subject. And then there were occasional like educational programs on television, you know, but those were usually pretty lame. But now I watch like my kids and they have YouTube, and YouTube has a lot of stupid stuff on it that they, you know, open up a Chrome tab while they're supposed to be in remote learning right now and watch Minecraft videos instead. But they also can, I catch them like that topic that caught their eye, they are just like plunging into videos about it. And there's this extraordinary resource. Or there's people kind of remixing learning. So there's a woman that my wife watches on Facebook video who does her makeup while telling true crime stories. And she just tells these like very detailed 20-minute, you know, this is this particular person and how like the murders and how they were caught and so on. And she's doing her makeup during it, which is totally bizarre to me, but is like utterly engaging, you know, and you can just like watch and you're learning a lot of stuff. And so it feels like a lot of the most interesting stuff in kind of the way that people can learn, especially like independently motivated people, is in places that educators or like the education community or the way that we think about traditional learning would see as like YouTube is this frivolous place where you waste time, or this woman doing her makeup isn't like real teaching. Is that like a problem as far as fixing things? Or is it, I mean, because I can see as the problem on one hand, but it's also like my kids are spending far more time doing what I would call like genuine independent study than I did when I was their age.
It's wonderful. I love it. And it, one thing I think about is often is how much I wish I had the 3 Blue 1 Brown math YouTube channel, Grant Sanderson's channel, when I was a kid learning math, because it is so much more interesting and better explained than, you know, anything I had available to me. So, you know, there's multiple factors that people are excited about, right? So one of them is that, I mean, this is kind of the Khan Academy story, like maybe you can find someone who's just really good at explaining stuff, and they might be better at explaining the thing than like the random teacher your kid happened to have, who's, you know, drawn from a large distribution of abilities. And you know, maybe the median performance of all teachers is kind of fine, but every teacher's going to have a thing that they are not so good at explaining, et cetera. So that there's this kind of like raise the floor type thing. What I find much more interesting is, I think what you're alluding to, and that's really like a change in focus or purpose. A great thing about the video medium is that it accesses emotional factors so much more easily than text. And so that, like, that's one of the things that I love about 3 Blue 1 Brown. Like, his love and curiosity and passion for this subject just come through in every video. And this is true of you know, minute physics and, you know, all these other things. So a challenge that I often hear when I talk to these people is like, they're not quite sure how they should think about what success is. Like Grant, for instance, expresses concern or like uncertainty. Like, the people watch these videos, millions of them watch these Baroque math videos, and enjoy them, seem to enjoy them. So what? Like, is that doing anything? And do we care? I mean, so if it's the case that all it's doing is providing entertainment and like there's nothing durable happening, maybe that's fine, like, because it shifts people's values towards finding math more interesting. Or maybe it's bad, and he should try to, you know, pursue, say, like efficacy to a greater degree, however you might define efficacy. And so there's a lot of uncertainty in that space, like even from the creators themselves. You know, as far as not the creators, then you run into all the problems we were talking about earlier, where it's, you know, your kids are doing this independent study, but like, how do we assess that on the summative test at the end of the year? I don't know. So I guess it isn't valued by the system.
In the pandemic time, we've seen a lot of things happen with schools. I mean, of course, many students not being in school and not getting effectively educated via Zoom. But we've also seen people thinking maybe different ways of doing things, different technologies. And there's always new educational philosophies out there that come and go in different ways and studies and things like this. I remember when my aunt was teaching in the 70s, one of the big fads was this open classroom model where they took down the walls of the classrooms. And then they were like, that was a really bad idea. We need to put the walls back up. And so it's always churning. And, you know, it's exciting if you think about it. I mean, this is a libertarian question, of course. It's exciting when you think about the possibilities and what Khan Academy did and all of the different things out there. Aaron mentioned YouTube and so many other things. And then whether or not the public school system can be a handmaiden to that situation or a hindrance. And my perspective is it's likely to be a hindrance because of all the swirling interests around it. I mean, even just textbook manufacturers in Texas hold an unbelievable amount of power over our public school system and teachers unions and all this stuff. So, you know, is it something that we should be paring back and like to encourage this kind of thousand flowers blooming? I don't know exactly how to educate kids the best, but we need to get out there, experiment. We should be moving in that model. And that in some sense, public schools, you know, are not something we should rely on to be good for that.
I think it really depends on what you value. If what you value is the opportunity for a higher variance outcome, then I think it's probably not something many people in the space would disagree with, that public schools are like not great for innovation, thousand flowers bloom type stuff. I mean, sometimes it happens, but almost like despite the institutional structures. And the reason why I think they wouldn't fight you on that is that they're basically tuning for a different thing on the landscape, which is they want lower variance outcomes, and they're maybe willing to accept a lower median as a result. And so, you know, if you're a person coming from a position of like relative security or something, like you might be interested in the higher variance outcome because like you can always do something else or, you know, whatever if it fails. So I don't quite know how to how to think about that, except that, you know, if those are two reasonable stances that people can have, then probably both groups of people should have ways to express that. And maybe that's charter schools for the people who are interested in higher variance outcomes and public schools for the people who are interested in lower variance ones. The challenges here, of course, come in the interactions between those groups and those institutions. There are claims that the existence of charter school programs has some causative effect on declining funding for nearby public school programs. And of those claims, like there are certainly instances where that is actually true and instances where it is exaggerated. So it's very difficult to piece this all apart.
If you look forward 10, 20 years, what does the ideal future of education look like? Like, how do you see, what would education look like a couple of decades from now if this all worked out and you were, you know, put in charge of it?
Well, if I had a concise and compelling vision I could articulate, I think that would be a wonderful thing. And, you know, much, much research would be done. I can describe some properties, I think, of what that world might look like. I would love to see a world in which students are enabled through carefully designed environments that don't necessarily look like schools. They might look more like what are called samba schools. In Latin America, essentially like community gathering centers, which involve people of all ages. And these places contain activities which are naturally appealing to the participants. And participating in those activities kind of naturally and inevitably causes enablement. So the an example that I find very interesting here and in a sort of a secular space is Y Combinator. A very interesting thing about Y Combinator is that it has effectively a curriculum, the existence of the structures of, say, office hours and meetings with their mentors and the pitch syllabus and so on. All of that amounts to a curriculum, but it's delivered in this kind of naturalistic fashion. And it's one where all of the participants are working on something that matters very deeply to them. So I'm very excited about the schools which are attempting to do something like this for K-12 type education. Ad Astra is an interesting example. The Khan Lab School is another interesting example. So I would love to see more of that. There's too many unknowns, really, to be sure. in the second half, the second main property I'd like to see is a deeper application of what is known about teaching and learning and doing effectively to these environments. So the memory systems that we discussed earlier is one. It's a fairly galling one, just because the core principles have been known for, depending on how you count, over a century or at least many decades, and yet they're still not part of this environment. And so it just kind of feels like we're leaving stuff on the table, you know, to the extent that kids are struggling to, you know, memorize some list of historical facts or vocabulary or the organic molecules that they have to know for the test. Like, that's essentially just heat loss. It's just wasted effort, and it doesn't have to be there. But the memory thing is like only one example, I think, of like a large set of cognitive augmentations, which are possible even just based on what we understand right now. And if we build those augmentations, then I think they will help us understand much more.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, make sure to rate and review us in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Free Thoughts is produced by Landry Ayers. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.